Are you confused about real food and what's healthy and good for the planet? Do you need the facts about local, organic, and sustainable food? Well, get ready to change the way you eat. Get ready for The Appropriate Omnivore with Aaron Zober.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. I'm your host, Aaron Zober, covering lifestyles in the world of real food. On October 17th, the Weston A. Price Foundation will be holding its annual Wise Traditions Conference, this year in Salt Lake City, Utah. As has been the tradition on The Appropriate Omnivore, I'll be interviewing several of the upcoming speakers. I kick off my speaker series with James Berry, founder of the organ meat seasoning known as Pluck. James' presentation at the conference is entitled, The Original Superfood, Why Organ Meats Belong Back on the Plate. James, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, Aaron.
It's always a pleasure having you on. I appreciate what you're doing, and with all that you have going, preparing for the conference and your business with Pluck, I appreciate you taking the time to come on here and give a little preview to the listeners of what you'll be talking about in October.
Absolutely. It occurred to me, I've never actually asked you, what is the appropriate mean to you for the name of your podcast?
So it's a nod to the author E.F. Schumacher, who wrote the book Small is Beautiful, and he talked about appropriate technology. It was a book in the 70s. That was the term for it, referring to renewable energy. And so appropriate omnivore, it's a similar concept. It's meat that's sustainable for the planet, it's humanely raised, and it's healthy for us.
Yeah. So in a sense, that naturally or ancestrally fits this human body that we're in?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And it very much speaks to more and more how I think and more and more where I delve into is I'm just constantly looking for ways for us to get in harmony with what is innately human. With the knowledge that innately human means inconsistency, means that we're going to be swayed by these frankenfoods, these highly intense flavored foods that have no nutrition, that we're going to go all over the place diet-wise if we're not mindful.
Totally. And I think it also has to do with going back to the earth, like you say, not having these frankenfoods, appropriate omnivores, eating meat that is as nature is intended, from the farm to your table and as little processing. Obviously, you have to go to processing plants to make it into the meats, but as little as possible that you're eating as close to what nature intended.
It is interesting to me, though, because one of the comments we get a lot from people that have not tried Pluck is they say, well, am I really getting enough? It's almost like they seem to be questioning how effective real food is. Mm-hmm. And I find that really fascinating because it's like, so you would prefer to either have it in a capsule or you would prefer to focus on these isolates, these products that are made in laboratories that are making health claims or speaking to having certain amounts of protein or certain amounts of nutrients. So you're not questioning those things, but you're questioning organ meat because we don't do anything to it. It's just organ meats. It's freeze-dried powdered. That's it. We don't add anything to it. We don't take away anything except water. To me, it's truly Mother Nature's multivitamin. It is as close to nature to a vitamin as nature intended that you can get. But yet for some reason, the human inclination, or at least in our current society, is to almost trust the bill of goods that's being sold marketing wise and what's made in the laboratory over what nature intended, to your point.
Yes, I think that a lot is not known about food in general, and especially organ meats. A lot of people have heard the demonization that they've received, or other people, I think, might not even know what organ meats are. Obviously, longtime listeners to the show will, but for anyone who, say, is listening for the first time, how would you describe organ meats to them?
I would, first of all, offer, okay, it's part of the animal, and in no place in history have we ever had the luxury to only eat part of the animal. Mm-hmm. Think of it this way. If you were in a tribe and hunters went out to kill an animal, brought it back, it would be equivalent to when they brought it back, you saying, I just want the ribeye. That's absurd. You would utilize the entire animal, and that would include the bones, that would include all the different cuts of meat, from the joints to the tail to the hooves. It would involve the organs, and that's why we focus on the organ meats as well, because one of the ancestral practices as well is the hunters would fast before they would go hunting, because that sharpened their hunting skills. It sharpens your senses. You can hear better, you can see better, all these things that you're more sensitive to. And one of the things that they would do after they made that kill is they would eat either the heart or the liver, and they would eat it raw right there. And they did that because they knew these are some of the most nutrient packed parts of the animal. It's almost like the equivalent of us going to a 7-Eleven when we're feeling ill and buying one of those emergency packs, whatever they call them, and downing one of those, thinking that it's going to support your immune system. But they were using nature. They were using what we're identifying even then the most nutrient dense part of the animal. It's more nutrient dense than muscle meat. And you can even look at how it's structured, right? So the muscle, the actual muscle structure, is harder to digest than the organ meat structure. And you can tell that when you just let them go to room temperature. If you let a muscle meat go to room temperature, yes, blood leaves it, but it's pretty intact. When you let liver go to room temperature, the entire liver starts to almost melt. I don't know the actual biology of it, of what you call it, but the actual structure of it is just more permeable. It's easier to break down. And then, of course, there's the concept of like supports like. So that idea that the organ you're eating is going to support that part in you. And if you think about it, when people are talking about building muscle, they suggest eat muscle. That makes sense. But one of the things we have to be worried about living in this, what I would say is a very toxic society or a toxic modern world, is we have to be aware of, like, okay, we're not going to be really able to avoid these toxins because they're everywhere. But what we want to be is resilient with them. We want to be able to detoxify from them so that they're not building up, so that we're not constantly exhausted from this burden, but that our bodies can process and get rid of these toxins. And so from that perspective, you want to eat organs that are detoxifying organs, because they're going to support the detoxification in your organs.
I like how you bring up the idea of eating all of the animal, because that is going back to what we done originally. I'd say that's very appropriate. And it's important to me because I very much got into the real food and the ancestral nutrition for the environmental aspects, even more than the health and eating all of the animal. That's very environmental, as meat has gotten a lot of accusations of being bad for the planet and criticisms of, well, is there enough meat to feed everyone? And yes, there is, especially if you eat all of the animals. And like you said, not just eat the muscle meats, the popular cuts that everyone wants.
Yeah. And though in the current systems, sadly, though, I think it does go a little deeper, because then you have to start talking about quality, right? So is there enough of 100% grass-fed beef to go around? No, there isn't. There's not enough farms that are doing it that way. Is there enough from big ag? Yes, but you may not want to eat some of the stuff that you get from that, right? Because I've heard, for example, the tallow, if more restaurants start wanting to cook product in tallow and more products are used with tallow, that they will run out. That's, for example, what I've heard. Now, I don't know where they're basing that from, but I can imagine that it's attached to supply chain. Is the supply chain set up for us to obtain all the parts of the animal? I know that when I went to a slaughterhouse in Wyoming, they flat out admitted to me that they waste about 50% of the animal. They throw it out because their slaughterhouse is not set up to capture all the parts of the animal. There is definitely more and more slaughterhouses that are, let's just say, the newer slaughterhouses, and there are not many, but as they create new ones, they are thinking more like that. But it's really challenging for slaughterhouses to shift if they've been following a certain protocol, a certain method of capturing parts of the animal for 50, 60, 70 years. It's really hard for them to change.
You're absolutely correct. And I've seen that a lot with conventional farming, that they don't serve all the cuts, say, the way that a grass-fed company would, some of these big ones that sell in stores or your local farmer. With conventional farming, yes, they don't sell them. And it has a lot to do with, I think, their audience, that they know that a lot of parts of the animals, they won't be able to sell to anyone, and they're not able to sell to restaurants. So we do need to do some educating. I know in the U.S., organ meats still have to catch on, really, with the masses. But in world cuisine, we see organ meat certainly more. Give us some examples of that.
Oh, yeah. Mexico is renowned for menudo. They're using the stomach lining, which is tripe. You have tongue being used as well. When we talk about organ meats, we're really talking about every part of the animal except the muscle and the bone. So they clump tongue, lips, eyes, they call all of those organs. Even in a sense, the hooves, or if you were talking about chickens, the feet. So that they would consider that part of the organ category. So it does show up everywhere. So you have, obviously in France, you have the pâtés, and pâté is really using multiple types of organs. A lot of times it's duck livers with pork liver as well. They're mixing species and pâtés. You have in Scotland, you have haggis, which is a mix of different organs. And ancestrally, or at least traditionally, it was actually cooked in the animal's stomach as well. I don't think they do that as much anymore, but they used to. So they were really utilizing as much of that animal as possible. You have blood sausage in Ireland. It really does show up everywhere. Even technically shows up in the U.S., but just shows up in the South. And that's chitlins. For example, those are pig intestines. So what's fascinating, though, when you look at the history, where it shows up around the world is usually dictated depending on where it is. I think France, in certain areas, it's just traditional. But I was speaking with someone who lives in France just a few days ago, and she was admitting that more and more people in France are seeing organ meats as poor people's food, as the thing you would buy if you didn't have the money or you were being frugal. And what's fascinating about that is that's how it showed up in the U.S. as well. That's why it lost favor. Is there's two kind of, well, maybe even a third, but there's two main historical points with organ meats. So initially, when they centralized the meat production in the Midwest, and then they had the railroad system, and they were freighting on the trains of muscle meat to the coasts, and you couldn't get the train cars cold enough to put organs in the train because organs need to be kept colder than muscle meat. And so they didn't send out the organs back then when that was starting. And so now you had other areas outside of the Midwest that were not eating their organs. They weren't getting them. They weren't there. And then you had a resurgence in World War II because basically there was a fear of protein shortage. So the government actually invested money in educating people on different ways to get their needs met and it not being muscle. And one of the things that they did was they created Meatless Mondays. That was a World War II thing. A lot of people think it came around in the 70s, but it was actually World War II. They created Meatless Mondays. They also, instead of calling them offal or awful, they called them variety meats and independence meats. They were trying to make it patriotic and it worked. That's why my mother, who was born in 46, I think, grew up eating liver and onions. So it did work. But then it lost favor again. And I think it lost favor with that generation because a lot of them were forced to eat it. And when you then couple any food with that emotional shaming or anything like that, you're going to have people that are like, well, I'm not going to do that with my kids. Or the minute I have control over my diet, I am not doing that. Right. So there's a backlash. But it also happened is when the soldiers came back from World War II, a lot of the women started working while they were gone and they didn't want to stop working. So you had households now that had two people that were working. They had more money coming in and they were like, hey, we can afford the roast beef. Let's not buy the liver or the tongue. And so it once again defaulted into that, well, this is for poor people. And the minute you stop buying it, and this is really where how we make change. It's funny because for the last 20 years of me being in this industry, I have looked and searched, how do we really make change? How can we truly make change? And the answer has sadly never shifted. It's always you vote with your dollar. So if you buy it, they'll keep making it. And that was absolutely true with organ meat. As people stopped buying it, they stopped carrying it. And as you stop carrying it, that means you have less and less households buying it. You have less and less households cooking it. And then there, of course, there's no sourcing of it. So you start to then over time lose the knowledge of those three things. And now that's where we are. We have people that think it's gross. They've never even tried it and they think they're gross. You have people that are intimidated by how to cook them. They're icked out by it. And they're like, I don't want to touch it. I don't know how to cook it. And then despite the internet and the access the internet provides, you still have people that are like, I don't know where to source it.
That's very interesting about World War II. In addition to being a food blogger and podcaster, I do also see myself as a food historian. And when I write these articles, I always want to give people a little bit of history. I think a lot of people are interested in that. And I found that a lot of our modern food system started with World War II.
Really did. Yeah, industrialization of things. Yeah, absolutely. It was a bountiful. What's so fascinating is it's coming up now. And a lot of people don't realize it, but when World War II was over, America was on a high. Like I said, two people were working in the household. There's more money coming into households. Everyone was like, oh, we're going to rule the world. America is the country to be. And China was at a low point. And what happened, what I'm hearing people write about now, is that the difference is that China started investing in basically becoming the place to go for not only cheaper product, but if you're manufacturing anything, you go to China. And because they put in the sweat of doing that, we, to a degree, rode on our laurels a little bit. We were a little bit in our egos over time that we then outsourced all that stuff. And I know that wasn't after World War II, that was later, but still, we then outsourced a lot of our industrialization to these countries that put their head down and were just focusing on strengthening that. And we're in the situation where we are now, where very little is produced here. And it's hurting our economy horribly.
So we've discussed a lot about the history of organ meats and why people aren't consuming them, how they feel about them currently. What would you give as easy steps for people to incorporate organ meats into their diet again?
Yeah, I would, first of all, look, pluck, even though I made it, it really is the easiest. And I think that's why so many of our friends at Weston A. Price love it for that. While we can all talk till we're blue in the face about how important organ meats are, even the best of us are still intimidated by them. It's funny, I'll talk to nutritionists or health practitioners who know that organ meats are important to get in the diet. And I'll say, so how long has that organ meat been in your freezer? And they're like, a year, 2 years. That's the truth, is if you don't cook it often, then it is intimidating. So I love the fact that I use it. Pluck. I don't cook organs otherwise. So that to me is the easiest entry point, because it's no different than a seasoning. If you can salt it, you can pluck it, you can put it on anything. So that's the easiest gateway to it. But in no means should you stop there. And I always advise, think outside the species. So while beef might be the most nutritious, it's not necessarily the place to start. Poultry is way milder. Typically, the milder the organs are, the less nutrient dense they are. But if we're talking about easing into the organ meats, that's where you want to start. So I would start with chicken hearts. Start with the organs that are closest to muscles.
Chicken hearts, that's one of my favorites.
Yeah, there you go. Chicken hearts are mild. They're even slightly sweet.
Yes.
And they have a firmer texture than the other organs. And I always recommend people just treat them like mushrooms. If you're making a sauce or something like that, or a soup or stew, just take three or four, chop them up just like you would a mushroom, dice them, throw them in. No one will know it's hearts. You won't even know it. You won't even think about the fact that it's hearts. It won't taste like a heart. It just tastes like a nice little piece. If anything, it tastes like a mushroom because it takes on the flavor of whatever you've added it to. So I always recommend you start there. And then when you're ready, graduate to the beef liver, because that is one of the more nutritious ones. And then just remember, though, that the most intimidating thing about the organ meats is when they're deep. So when they're at room temperature, that is when they're the most intimidating, because it's a different texture than muscle meat. Like I said earlier, they melt a little bit. It's just they get slimy and they break down. You can't keep them in your refrigerator very long uncooked. They will go bad very quickly. So you really want to keep them frozen as long as possible. And I always recommend just pull them out whenever you're making ground meat and just grate it right into the ground meat, then put it right back in the freezer when you're done. And the key is just keep the ratios low, because you don't need a lot. You don't need much.
Yeah, actually, that's what I do. Yeah, I just take the chicken hearts out of the freezer and cook them. Yeah, works easily. And it's interesting you mentioned chicken hearts, because that was very much my introduction to organ meats when I first got involved with Weston A. Price Foundation. And I started going to a local chapter. I think the second meeting, this doctor brought chicken hearts as part of the potluck. And oh, I was certainly excited to try them because I was getting into all this and loved them. Yeah, they have a very different taste than liver. They have a harder texture too. I think that's the thing about them. You don't want the soft foods. And like you said, they have more of a sweet taste. It doesn't have so much of the bitter taste that a liver would have. Yeah, chicken hearts, I 100% agree, are a good introduction to them.
Yeah, we have to remember, going back to what we talked about when we first started, is we're humans. And for better or for worse, we have very specific preferences. We look for comfort and we would look for stability. And I don't think we need to fight that necessarily. I think, though, that we just have to have a little curiosity around it. So, for example, you trying those chicken hearts before you even knew what they tasted like, a lot of people aren't even willing to do that. There's so much fear in change that they let that fear overtake them and not even try the chicken hearts. And you did. And then you were like, oh, these are actually really good. And then now what happens when we start to incorporate anything into our diet, it shifts our palate. So if you're drinking lots of sweet drinks, your palate will shift towards more sweet. And then that means that whatever you're eating, your dominant tastes are, those will shape your palate and dictate how other things taste. I'll use the example of soda. Anyone remember growing up and during those periods where you're drinking all the sodas and the juices and stuff like that? And then when you would drink water and you're like, ugh, it's so plain, right? Mm-hmm. That is a sign of not that water is bad for you, but that your palate's messed up. Your palate needs to be recalibrated. And most of us here in the US, for those that don't remember, because you learned this in school, our tastes are sweet, salty, bitter, sour. And there's a fifth called umami that they discovered in the 90s in Japan. And they're even suggesting there might be a sixth that is rancid. When something's rancid, that has its own flavor as well. But we'll focus on the five. So you have those five. Most palates in the US skew towards salty and sweet. Why do they skew towards salty sweet? Because everything you buy in the grocery store is salty or sweet. Even a lot of that Frankenfood we were talking about earlier, most of it is high in salt or sugar. And they use it not only for flavor, but they use it as a preservative. So that's why our palates are skewed that way. So that means when we eat things that are bitter or sour, they're really bitter and sour because of that contrast. And so then people eat them and they go, oh, I don't want that. Talk to someone who's used to eating oranges and sweet berries and pineapple. They're not going to like grapefruit, guaranteed, right? So what I believe is so important for us is to, first of all, realize that if you don't like something, it could be two things. It could be your palate is not calibrated towards it, or it could be that your body is rejecting it, is telling you, hey, you don't need this. Now, the only way, though, to figure out which is the answer is to eat it, to actually eat it and see how do you feel after you eat it. Because I guarantee most people what happens when they eat the organ meats is, yeah, it tastes a little weird at first because you're not used to it, but it feels so good in your body. So that's a sign of, oh, it's just my palate. My body clearly wants and needs this.
There's another way that I see that organ meats are present in the US, albeit it's much smaller way, but you talked about the South. I can also think of in different cultures, organ meats are present. And as we're starting to get into exploring different ethnicities, for me, my introduction to organ meats, although I confess that as a kid, I didn't really have it much, but being Jewish at delis, you'd have tongue sandwiches. And I also think of now where I live in LA, because of the Mexican population, there's actually a food truck a couple of blocks from my house that serves tripe as one of their meats for the burritos in it, the taco trucks. And I can also think of Vietnamese food being popular. The popular banh mi is actually an organ meat pate. So those are certainly ways that I think people can introduce organ meats if they think of it as exploring worldly cuisine.
Love that. Yeah, absolutely. Just using tongue, for example, next time you're at a taco place that's more authentic than Americanized, and if they have lengua, get it as a taco, try it. I guarantee it's flavorful. It's very flavorful. Not only is the tongue more affordable than the ribeye, it's got more flavor and it's more nutritious. So it's one of those things that once you get a taste for it, you may actually want to start buying tongue, because whereas the other cuts of meat can be as high as $26 a pound, the tongue is typically about $6 or $7 a pound. So it's a huge. You can cut your grocery bill considerably just by starting to eat other parts of the animal.
Yes. When I first started learning about all this, that was an advantage that someone explained, was that organ meats, because they're less popular, they're way more affordable. And that certainly is a great thing if your excuse is, I can't afford to eat healthy.
Yeah. And then to your other point of it showing up in other ethnicities, if you can't find it at your local store, just go to your local international market, whether it's an Asian market or Mexican market, they will have it guaranteed. Now, typically, if it's in the Mexican market, it's going to be in the butcher area. But if it's in the Asian market, it may actually be in the freezer. So I would check both, but it absolutely will be there. And while it may not be 100% grass fed, I don't think the billions of people that already eat it in Asia, I don't think are wrong. So give it a try. Sometimes we can squabble or get really granular around these details of 100% grass fed, pastured. And while, yes, I would choose that if you can, but the other side of that argument is like, well, if you can't find grass fed, does that mean you don't eat it? And I would offer that the benefits far outweigh you not eating it. So if the international markets are where you can get it, try it, use it, and see how you feel. Your body will thank you for it.
I agree. And now one of the most important meats to bring up with that, if you can't find it grass-fed, is liver. And I know there's a lot of myths concerning how the liver actually functions. So would you say that it's okay to even get liver if it's not grass-fed?
That's probably where you could get a little more granulars, because those are detoxification organs and you want to make sure that they are coming from healthy animals. But I would offer too that the industry doesn't really let those animals age very long. They're slaughtered pretty young. And I think they're slaughtered before they can really acquire too much toxic burden. I don't know anyone that's actually genuinely tested it to see, is it truly toxic? Does it truly have any issues? My understanding from, there was a book called Sacred Cow, Rob Wolf and his co-author, they talked about how actually there isn't that big of a difference nutritionally between conventional and grass-fed. Now, I know there's other people that get very upset by that and believe that's not true. But either way, I think the point is more that it's not as drastic as everyone thinks it is. So what are the two main concerns with liver and kidney? One of them is that they store the toxins. Okay, that's one. So let's first address that. Basically, when you say, oh, well, they store the toxins, you're insinuating that the organ is a sponge and that anything it absorbs, it just doesn't release. It just holds onto it. And if that were true, we would all be dead because the world is very toxic. There's many toxins in our water, air, soil. And so the job of these organs is to help you survive. The job is to take the toxins that come inside your body to turn them water soluble so that they can then leave your body through your poop, your pee, or your sweat. So the key is less, what is that? Where does it store? The key that I would offer everyone should be thinking about is, am I sweating, pooping, and peeing? Make sure that your elimination pathways are working properly. If you're not pooping daily, that's a problem. If you're not peeing regularly and your pee is very dark, that's a problem. Those are the places I would focus. Make sure your elimination pathways are working. The other thing is that when toxins get stored, if they're not eliminating properly, they don't get stored in the organ itself. They get stored in fat. And yes, you can get fat building up around the organs, and that's where the toxins could get stored. But most of the people have those toxins that are going into the fat that's outside, that's under their skin. That's where most of the fat is going. So really, you want to think about it like, well, I'm going to eat that organ because it has a plethora of those nutrients that support detoxification. And I want help with my own organs to detoxify. So that's myth number one. The other one, and I love talking about this one, is, well, if I eat organs, I'm going to get too much. I'm going to get too much vitamin A. Because, for example, liver is very high in vitamin A. They call it vitamin A toxicity. I would offer this. We ancestrally are in Homo sapien bodies. This body is developed hundreds of thousands of years ago. The body biologically was designed to determine two things. Is this food I'm about to eat going to kill me, or is it going to nourish me? There is a communication pathway that has been established for thousands of years to inform us of those two points. And then also to tell us how much of this food do I need, when to stop. Now, fortunately, back in the day, food was so nutritious. We were eating from the source and the food was nutritious. So our bodies could communicate, hey, you're full. You've got enough. Right? You were also moving so much in your life that you didn't see people as overweight as they are now. I would offer that when we eat food and we use our senses, these communication pathways that have been established biologically to inform us of what our body needs and wants. When we eat our food and we eat it mindfully enough, meaning slow enough, that communication will happen and your body will never let you overeat liver or anything. And we can even think about it from perspective of salt. If I put salt on your tongue, your body makes the salt taste differently the third or fourth time I put it on your tongue. It tastes completely different than the first time. And your body starts to reject it and say, stop, this doesn't taste good. You almost get that feeling of, ugh, I want to get the salt off my tongue. It feels gross. But if I swallow a salt tablet, maybe I take three of them. I get zero communication. And maybe 30 minutes later, I'm like, God, why am I so bloated? It's because you got too much of something. Your body didn't have time to communicate to you how much or when to stop or if it even liked it. So when I speak to that specific myth, and it's called our neurolingual response, what I'm emphasizing is that it is our job to use our body in its biologically designed way. And that is eat your food, eat nutrient-rich foods, eat foods that have flavors that are found in nature, not natural flavors, but found in nature flavors. And then just eat it mindfully. Just eat it slowly enough where you allow that biological communication pathway to operate as it should. And you will see, you'll feel better in your body and you'll make completely different choices.
Those are two great points to bring up in regards to the myth of liver being bad and liver from non-grass-fed animals. Vitamin A is an important vitamin for us. Pam Schoenfeld, she's done lots of talks about that. She's been on a podcast talking about this. You can go back and listen to that if you want to learn more about vitamin A and the importance of it. It's been demonized because it comes from animal products, but it's something that we all need. And in regards to how the liver works, as you talked about, it's not a sponge. Or I like how Chris Masterjohn puts it, the liver is not a coffee filter. So for that reason, I'm not so concerned about having a liver from a non-grass-fed, non-pastured animal, because it's not what people think. Not all the stuff, like you said, gets stored in it. It neutralizes it.
Yeah, our bodies are miraculous. They are designed to thrive. And I think it's very short-sighted. Think about the people that have so many vices that are so bad for your health, whether it's smoking for such long periods of time or eating horrible food or staying up late and getting very little sleep for so much of their life, drinking tons of alcohol, whatever it is. And yet look how long they live. The body is miraculous. Mm-hmm. We're undermining it constantly if we think that eating anything or utilizing anything that is as natural as organ meats and foods that are truly ancestral, meaning that they're in alignment with our human DNA, that they would ever be bad for us. There's no way. And particularly when you do it in alignment with your biological processes. If you're eating the food, your body will communicate. It will tell you, it will make you stop. That's what's so absurd, even with juice, for example. Yeah, you can have a glass of juice, let's say apple juice, and there'll be five apples that were juiced for that glass, right? Well, that's abnormal. We didn't have juicers back in the day, right? But think about it this way. Would you ever eat five apples in a row? I don't know about you, but my body wouldn't let me. I'd be like, oh, I'm done. Maybe after two, I'd be done. Max, you know what I'm saying? So the body does have a communication pathway. We just got to start listening to it and utilizing it properly, or when, I should say appropriately.
Yes.
Appropriately.
And also you wouldn't eat five apples just alone. You would eat some kind of protein with them, which I think is my biggest issue with juice, is a lot of times it's just fruit and no protein right at all in there.
Yeah, totally. Well, and then no fiber as well. So there's nothing that's saying, oh, slow down this blood sugar rush, or just slow down the process of how this is integrated. But yeah, even if I were eating it, I still wouldn't eat five apples with protein.
That's,
you know, what I'm saying? Same with protein. You're going to stop at one point. If you're eating it, you will stop at one point, because your body will just be like, either you'll max out your stomach or your body will just say, hey, I'm good. I would say the biggest thing we're thwarting there is we're either eating too fast, we're distracted when we're eating, we're on screens or whatnot, or we're in movement, or we're just simply not being mindful as we do it. We're just checked out. And I think that is resulting, and then we're not listening. So I think that results in that the communication that our body is providing us is being disregarded. And yet it's the most purest form of communication. You and I could talk diets all we want, but the reality is our body informs us of which diet works for us. And so we need to be listening to it. And yet most people, they're getting skin rashes, they're having overweight issues, they're having sleeping, they're having all these issues physically, and they're not listening, and they think it's something other than what they're eating. No, it probably starts with what you're eating, because you're doing that every day.
Absolutely. Yeah, food is a lot of where things start. Going back to how we're talking about how now people are more interested in exploring other ethnic cuisines, that's something that certainly is a way to get the Gen Z more organ meats. But then we have the Gen Alpha, as they call it now, the youth, the people under 18. And with kids, you got a lot of picky eaters. So what tips would you give for these parents of picky eaters to consume more organ meats?
Once again, I know it's going to sound self-serving since I made it, but I say use Pluck, because it really does. I was a picky eater growing up, and I have kids, and it solves all of it. Because what we're dealing with picky eating is sometimes it's chemical, in terms of sometimes you have some spectrum kids that you can definitely be a picky eater and not have it be emotional, but more physical or chemical. So there's definitely that side of it. But for many of us, specifically, if I speak just for myself, it was emotional back when I was younger. And it was my way of finding control Or if I can't control the life outside me, I can at least control what goes inside me. And so I was a very picky eater, did not grow up eating organ meats. And I love the fact that I can just sprinkle it on and I don't touch it. So there's no texture to it. I don't need to know how to cook it. And it tastes really good. I don't taste the organ meats. I taste the onion. I taste the salt. I taste the garlic. I taste the other things in it. And yeah, while I'm not getting extreme levels of it every time I use it, but the key is I'm getting micro amounts of it, but I'm using it all the time. And so microdosing plus frequency equals cumulative effect. And so we get feedback. I did not know this when I created Pluck, but we have gotten feedback that practitioners are now suggesting to their clients with kids that are picky. They're saying, hey, all I want you to do differently is use Pluck. And they're getting reported back that the parents are like, oh my gosh, my kids love it. And they're starting to adventure to trying new foods. And I'm like, oh, that's so interesting because that speaks to the palate. When Pluck is very umami, and that's that fifth taste that I talked about earlier. What happens when you get a unique flavor like umami, it actually brightens the other flavors. So anything you add it to, it's going to make that food taste better, not only because of the ingredients, but mostly because of that umami. And so what you have is, what, let's say you're sprinkling on, I don't know, you could be mixing in. Let's take a kid who just eats dino nuggets and let's say ketchup. The way that I would incorporate Pluck there is I would mix it into the ketchup. And once the kid starts to get the palate for it, the flavor for it, then I would make them aware of, hey, I've been adding this seasoning to it. That's why you like it so much. Do you want to just taste this seasoning on its own? Well, sure. And then they taste it. And then now they like it. And now they're intentional of, oh, the flavor's coming from the seasoning. And then you can start saying, well, let's put it on other things. Hey, we're having popcorn tonight when we watch a movie.
One of my favorites. Some on
the, right? It's my favorite too. Let's put it on the buttered popcorn. I got my daughter to eat broccoli, not because she wanted the broccoli, but because I said, how about I put lots of butter on it and I sprinkle Pluck on that? And she said, okay, I'll eat the broccoli, because she knew it was going to have the butter and the Pluck. So once the kid is aware that this is the thing that's bringing all this really good flavor, then you really can start to help them be more adventurous. And you may even find that they just naturally want to be more adventurous, just because now their palate is being skewed a little bit due to the savory, and it's not so skewed towards the sweet and the salty.
I'm a ketchup lover. I'll even put it on a hot dog. So I'm going to try that now, of mixing some Pluck seasoning into my ketchup.
Absolutely, because ketchup already has flavor, right? So you could definitely add one of the flavored ones. But let's just say for you, you were like, well, I use ketchup every day. I just want to get the organ meat nutrition. We have the pure product, which is just 100% organ meat. You could take a fourth of a teaspoon or even a half a teaspoon, depending on how much ketchup you eat. Just put that in the ketchup. And now you still get the ketchup flavor, but now you've boosted the ketchup to be very nutritious. So really, you could do either or, but either way, it's a great vehicle to get the organ meats. That's something a parent could do easily, particularly one that is less worried about flavor and is more worried about getting nutrient-dense foods in their kids' diets. I would just get the pure. A little bit goes a long way. So 1 teaspoon of pure is equal to 2 ounces of organs. So for a kid, I would start with a fourth of a teaspoon. You don't need much. If you're an adult, I would start with half a teaspoon and just see how your body does. For some people, when they start using Pluck or getting any organs into their diet, they feel a surge of energy. And so when you first ease into it, because most of us are not prepared for such an efficient, nutrient-dense food as organ meats are, I do recommend you ease into it. You don't go all out. Don't just suddenly have liver and onions your first time. You know what I mean? If you're using Pluck Pure, don't put a tablespoon into your food right away, because you really want to make sure that you ease into it. You see how your body responds and then follow your taste buds. Because if you're a woman, for example, certain times of the month, you may want more. Other times you might want less. So you want to follow your body's cravings for it and your own personal needs.
Could you see Pluck expanding into some of these things you've talked about? For instance, condiments using the Pluck seasoning.
Absolutely. I think the first obvious place for us to go is snack foods. Like we both just said, popcorn is so good with it. I've been looking for companies to partner with to get the product on. I was going to work with Rich's Nuts. They were going to do Pluck Nuts, for example.
Oh, that's a great one.
Rich's Nuts is a sprouted nut company that usually shows up at the Weston A. Price conferences.
Right. That was my thought. Two Wise Traditions frequent exhibitors pairing up together. Beautiful.
And they did a test of it and it was phenomenal. So good. But they just have been struggling a bit with production and stuff, so they couldn't take it on. But I'm still looking for a Sprouted Nut Company, popcorn, chips, tortilla chips or potato or otherwise. But I think that would be the most obvious place to go first. And then, yeah, eventually adding it to sauces and things like that. We are going to definitely be expanding the line of seasonings, though. So we currently have 4 products. One of them is the pure, and then we have 3 flavors. We're going to be coming out with soon, in a month or two, we're going to have habanero lime coming out.
Ooh,
that's going to be for the people that really like spicy.
That's very up my alley. Yes.
Yeah, really spicy.
Spicy and sour, too. It goes to the sour tooths.
Yep. Tangy. Exactly. Yeah. And so that we have that. And then we're going to have cinnamon brain. So we're going to be helping people get brain into their diets. And it's coming from New Zealand. So they've never had any kind of mad cow disease ever. So it's a very clean, great source for brain. And then we're going to also have pure brain. And we have chimichurri coming as well. Chimichurri. And it's going to be a limited run bison. So we're also going to be exploring other species. We hope to also have poultry coming soon. And then we're going to do a whole sardine. So the entire sardine will be freeze dried and powdered. That's the bones, the heads, everything, the fillet, all of it. And that will be in our sardine line. That will be a lot of curries.
I'm excited to try all these. Do you think you'll have them ready by the time of the Wise Traditions conference?
I hope to have habanero lime and the cinnamon brain. I don't think I'll have the others yet. The sardine and poultry would come in 2026. Wise Traditions is in October, so it will be tight, but we're trying to have it ready for then, yes.
All right. Well, I'm very excited to have the potential to try these in October. And in addition to the seasonings that you have, and you talked about some of your favorite things to make with the Pluck seasonings, what is your favorite organ meat dish to cook?
I don't cook organs very much. I am very much a product. I am that guy who I use the product I made. I very much use Pluck multiple times daily. I would say, though, when I do make organs, my go-to is the tongue. When we do tacos or something, I'll use the tongue.
Yeah, tongue is a great one, and because it is served in delis, and it has some similarity to a corned beef and a pastrami.
Absolutely. And then I still buy ancestral grounds, so the ground meats that have the liver or the heart are
Yes.
So I do a lot of that kind of stuff.
Those too are great. Yes, Force of Nature has some great ones, and also I've seen a lot of local ranchers that will sell those blends.
Absolutely. And one thing people can do is you can take the pure that we have and you can just add that to whatever the ground meat you're eating. It doesn't matter what species. It could be lamb, could be turkey. Just add half a teaspoon or a teaspoon of that to a pound of meat, and you just put 2 ounces of organs. If it's a teaspoon, you put 2 ounces of organs into that ground meat and you won't taste it. You just got to incorporate it well. And then what I love about the pure is it's great for baby's first food. So when you're making, let's say, mashes or anything like that, you're adding a little bit. You don't need much for a baby. So we're talking like a pinch, but you're adding that to their purees. And then I also give it to my pets. Sadly, we just lost our cat, not because she passed away, but because she went missing. We think a coyote got her. But basically, she was so addicted to pure Pluck that she would not eat unless I put it on her food. And I don't mean once. I'm talking every time. Let's say if I put it on the top, she ate the top, then she would ask for more. She kept wanting it on the top of her food. And it was both amusing and annoying because I had to cater to her needs a lot.
James, we're just about out of time. But before we go, let the listeners know where they can go online and on social media to learn more about Pluck.
Sure. You can find Pluck at eatpluck.com. We have lots of opportunity for you to even save on your first purchase. So there's lots of codes and ways. When you go to the site, you'll see you're immediately provided a 15% discount. Subscription also lowers the cost as well. So we try to make it as accessible as we can. We also sell on Amazon, and then we can be found on socials at eatpluck, and I'm at Chef James Berry. And you can check out our podcast, Everyday Ancestral, on basically your favorite platform. But it's all about taking the best from the past and making sure we bring it into our modern day.
Wonderful. James, pleasure to have you on again, and I look forward to hearing your talk in October.
Thank you, Aaron, and thank you for having me, and I look forward to seeing you too. Yeah.
Yes, that's all for this episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. New episodes of the show are released every Wednesday. Follow me on social media for more information on the next episode. And to make sure you never miss any of my podcasts, subscribe to The Appropriate Omnivore on your favorite podcast site or app. You can also listen to all my podcasts on my website, appropriateomnivore.com. There you can find recipes from the guests I interview, plus all of my articles covering lifestyles in the world of real food. Until next time, my pantry is officially closed.